Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can I welcome you to this meeting of the Global Strategy Forum? It's marvelous to see such a fantastic turnout. That the chair, quite literally, seems to be occupied, and that is very much to the credit of the chairman of the Global Strategy Forum, Michael Lodin, who is with us there. The purpose of our meeting today, you're all very familiar with the program. It's a normal format. Our speaker will speak for 20, 30 minutes, and then we'll have up to a half an hour for questions, and we finish on the dot at 2 o'clock. Our speaker today is Stephen Gray. He is a special correspondent with Reuters in London. He is best known for having been one of the persons who uncovered details of the CIA's secret rendition program. And he has, of course, also been a former foreign correspondent with the Sunday Times, as well as a number of other matters of that kind. He has been the author of a book that has come out recently called The New Spy Masters, Inside Espionage from the Cold War to Global Terror. I had the privilege of being asked to review the book for The Spectator some months ago. I did so. The review appeared. I was rather disconcerted when the headline, I'm not sure what Stephen will say about it, but the headline that they gave to my review was, James Bond would be bored in today's MI6, says Malcolm Richards. There was some comment of that kind that I made, but it wasn't meant to be the ultimate headline. I am obviously fascinated myself to hear what Stephen has to say, having had some involvement with the intelligence agencies over the years. I don't hold them in unrestricted awe. The very first time I went to the CIA headquarters in Langley, about 12 years ago, I was with Madeleine Albright, and we were meeting the Leon Panetta, then head of the CIA, and as we were leaving, I was given a commemoration CIA mug, a coffee mug covered with CIA insignia, and I happened to turn it upside down, and it said, made in China. That's quite true, I promise you. When I asked the aide with me, I said, I hope at least this is Taiwan. He said, we don't know. So that was disconcerting. But enough from me. I now have very great pleasure in inviting Stephen to address us.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming today. It's a great honour to be here and for so many such distinguished people to be here today with, I know, a great deal of knowledge and some of you about this subject too. Let me start with a word from Captain George Hill, who was a British Secret Service officer in 1917 revolutionary Russia. Spies in the British service commonly take up their dangerous duty out of sheer love of adventure, he said. And we often see spies as action men. But I found the real story to be a little more complex and interesting. Hill, at one point undercover, running a Moscow antique shop.
They're just bugging the place, that's all.
He was among a generation of Secret Service officers who was a spy himself. But confronted by the zealous attentions of Soviet counterintelligence, Hill found quickly that the love of adventure was not enough. Gifted as he was, he could not pass as a local, and found himself, quotes, again and again compelled to resort to the employment of nationals, that's local agents. And that became the pattern. So today, a real-life James Bond, the professional intelligence officer, is generally a spy master, not a spy. He finds someone else, a local man or woman, to act as his agent, to go and steal secrets, and to bear most of the risk. And Bond is also a civil servant. He has, I was surprised to learn, performance indicators. And also, people involved tell me they have to fill out risks, assessment forms, before they leave bases these days. So, spying may be the second oldest profession, but what's new about the last century of spying is that we have created a permanent secret service, the permanent spy bureaucracy. Let me quote Erskine May from 1863, "Nothing is more revolting to Englishmen than the espionage which forms part of the administrative system of continental despotism," he writes. But modern history has bequeathed us with a spy service and spy masters that we cannot and should not abolish, certainly not with the nuclear genie out of the bottle in the 20th century. Permanent spying, on the positive side, has given us spy masters who are accountable, at least to senior politicians, and who are not, for the most part, out of control. But the spy world can be a little different than portrayed, either in fiction or in propaganda. So to contrast a speech from in 2004 from the CIA's James Pavitt, who was quoting lines from Rudyard Kipling's Kim to describe the clandestine service he was just retiring from. From time to time, God causes men to be born who have a lust to go abroad at the risk of their lives and discover news. Well, up to a point. Contrast that romantic picture with an anecdote from Afghanistan a little while ago. An officer in today's Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, was apologising to a Western commander because he couldn't join a helicopter ride planned for a couple of days' time to a town newly liberated from the Taliban. "Sorry, I can't get the business case through London by then," he said. So, to be clear, there is plenty of adventure in the lives of our Secret Service, and always skullduggery. But in the way I've tried to describe modern human intelligence humans, I've tried to give a flavour of what the spy game is really like, and it's often a little less glamorous than portrayed, and where it's the agents our agencies employ, usually amateurs, who are the ones who live, to use the American phrase, in harm's way. And I do write as an outsider, obviously. I know just a fraction of the secret methods and operations that some, including some in this room, know about. But in my research, I've been lucky to be informed by some of the best, people without any grudge or interest. I've interviewed people who together represent many decades of intelligence work. So I'm going to try and quickly discuss what's different about spying today, and we can pick up on any of the points later if you're interested in them. But let me first quickly share some home truths about the craft of spying that so many in the business I've spoken to have emphasised to me. And some of them are a little counterintuitive. So firstly, the fragility of human intelligence. It's been striking to me how many of the really top-class spy masters I've met harbour such real doubts about whether they really had any value. Sometimes, as in Iraq recently, secret intelligence did no good because it was flimsy, untested by public scrutiny, and by definition hearsay, reports of agents can easily be wrong. But even good, accurate intelligence fails too when it's irrelevant or isn't believed. And it's incredible, and I've been amazed when I've found some of the people behind some of the great scoops, intelligence scoops of recent years, to find out how often they will tell you that for all the plaudits they received, how little they were believed at the time. There are famous public cases of that. Kim Philby, the great master spy, the best of all liars, but yet widely disbelieved by his masters in Moscow. Ditto Richard Sorge, predicting the German invasion of Soviet Russia, the Soviet spy in Tokyo, again disbelieved. And it's been the same on the Western side. You'll find, I've found many people who will describe their disappointments of such success but so little impact. The CIA, for instance, got all the plans down to unit level for the 1973 Yom Kippur attack by Egypt. The officer involved who pulled off that coup got a great medal afterwards and kudos. But the actual report was disbelieved and completely ignored. And there's no accident here, because by its nature, spy reports are necessarily second-hand, and they come from anonymous people who, by profession, may be serial betrayers. It's no wonder that errors occur and why readers want to see corroboration. It's natural, too, as journalists know, that the bigger the scoop, the more shocking the revelation, the harder it is to persuade the reader. But understanding this grey, crumbly nature of spying is not to dismiss or to underplay the value of spying. Because I think it's only when you realise its fragile nature that you can fully appreciate its function and come not to over-rely on secret intelligence or to wrongly blame it when you get surprises. When it's corroborated, when the context is understood, a spy's report can be decisive. And I've seen the consequences of missing human in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I've seen the benefits of good secret human too. The second lesson, I think, from the veterans of the business is that human is a niche operation. Thanks to Snowden, we know the CIA's annual budget is $14 billion, more than the GDP of Iceland. But that covers a multitude of sins. For all the dollars, the actual numbers of people involved in running agents are comparatively small. And those that are actually capable of recruiting a hard target, a few handfuls. The skill involved and the attention required to these operations is just too scarce to be spread thinly. Britain's SIS is focused much more exclusively on agent running, but its resources are limited. So, secret intelligence gathering, as I've learned, is a highly focused craft. The best operations demand huge concentration and often huge amounts of time. And because they're so carefully directed, they generally offer a narrow drinking straw field of view. There was a recent European Chief of Station conference. It wasn't open to the public, but the Director of US Central Intelligence, John Brennan, was there. And according to someone I know present, was asked about the traditional definition of spying, stealing secrets. He said, "I don't like to use the word steal. Actually, we gather information." Analysts apparently would, in future, rule and lead. Brennan's a former analyst. But he's wrong, I think. Spying is very much about stealing secrets. But he's right that to direct spycraft and to interpret its product, you need a solid base of basis of analysis and understanding from much wider open sources. As a senior official of the Joint Intelligence Committee put it to me, most so-called intelligence failures are really diplomatic failures. They're failures of tasking, of judging where to direct this precious resource of secret intelligence, foreseeing where the really important secrets are that need stealing. The third thing that people in the business remind you of is that secret intelligence is just one part of the work of a secret service. To call them intelligence agencies is a little misleading because they're there to do all of what a government needs to doing in the shadows. So much of what passes for spy work, for example, possibly, arguably, far too much, is really liaison, picking up secret material from foreign states or secret diplomacy. One job of the SIS in Kabul until recently was to run the UK relationship with President Karzai. And as I describe in this book, another vital role of secret services is to opening channels to talk to and understand our enemies in a discreet way, in a way that official diplomacy cannot do. So not all of the work of spy masters involves betrayal. Anyway, those are the defining features of the business, but what's changed, particularly since the Cold War, which was where spying has been much documented? Well, I'd just like to highlight two things today. Firstly, the shifting target of espionage, how the secrets we need and thus the spies we need have changed. And secondly, the new techniques of spying, because spying is not redundant, it's adapted. Firstly, the changing enemy. The key difference from the Cold War and post 9/11 is no doubt the overwhelming focus on counterterrorism. We've already had substantial background in counterterrorism. The IRA was defeated by penetration. Quite a controversial, surprising statement, but it came from someone quite senior in SIS. But whether he's right or not, if Human did not win the war, it did prevent the British Army losing. I describe the story in the book about the British agent Stakeknife in the IRA and some of the techniques learned in Ireland, which are still valuable today. But Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not the IRA. Just after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about how different it could have been if we'd got the intelligence right, and if there'd been a spy, sort of like Stakeknife, at the very top of Al-Qaeda, a man sitting on a rock next to Osama bin Laden to hear his plans and strategy. And a very senior official in the CIA told me that if they'd had someone there, they could have prevented the plot. But the problem was that Al-Qaeda was never a sufficient priority in intelligence tasking for long enough to ever have achieved that kind of agent. But as Richard Dearlove, former chief of SIS, pointed out here, in fact, and at other occasions, after 9/11, the chance was gone. Al-Qaeda became disparate, like a flock of birds. The great recruitments of the past had taken years and involved working a spy up through the enemy hierarchy. That applied as much to terror groups like the IRA as it did to state adversaries like the Soviet Union. But today's enemy no longer had such a hierarchy. They were in perpetual flux. He argued then that to beat the terrorist, what you needed, more than spies, was mass surveillance. You needed to watch travel plans and give the government access to data flows. Others have pointed out that not only are modern network terror groups harder to penetrate, their secrets may be of less value and certainly much more distributed than within a state adversary. Groups like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, ISIS have adopted something very close to what John Robb calls open source warfare. A great deal of their intentions, strategies, and even orders are public. And if you were sitting next to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi right now, you might find him on his Twitter account. Now, they do send plenty of secret messages, and they are worth intercepting and interpreting. But these enemies increasingly talk and adapt in the open. And the real secrets of importance are often held at a much lower level, or if known at the top, are very tightly held and rarely written down. The result is, it's very hard to think of one well-placed agent who could find out all you need to know. They might have known in Raqqa that something was going down in Paris, or even in San Bernardino, but it's still unclear from public information so far that anyone would have known who was in the proved, in many cases I know about, of decisive value in saving lives, where it's been possible to run agents, has been spying at a much lower tactical level, say an insider close in with the jihadi brothers of Molenbeek preparing to bomb Paris. Such people are usually linked to the senior hierarchy. There's a spectrum of a relationship between the operator who carries out an attack and the centre. And they may take orders. There are very few lone wolves around. They will likely know only about their own little group's plans. But penetrating that cell may be the only practical way to stop their plot. So how does this new landscape of threat change the nature of spying? Well, firstly, it's clear the spy has to operate within limits. Spying among people who are actively engaged in crime or killing is always going to present some problems. At what point do you pull the agent out? At what point do you intervene and stop the plot? In Ireland, there were many good techniques developed to keep agents alive and to make use of intelligence to bring a terrorist to court or to seize a weapon or stop a plot, all without exposing an agent. Even so, what's hard, as it was in Ireland and is today in Raqqa or Birmingham, is when an agent finds out about an attack that's imminent. You have to act decisively to prevent a murder, and no one disputes that. But this means you may have to retire your agent and end the spy mission. In the 21st century, where the terror has become the priority of intelligence work, and the modern terrorist is so brutal and so fanatical, this limit on spying is decisive. As one Western official put it, in countering terrorism, intelligence is subordinate to action. Acting is automatic and preempt long-term intelligence counter. And the need for action also trumps the process of bringing a terror group to justice. I tell the story of a French agent in a jihadi cell in Barcelona, for example, not so long ago, whose spying had to be terminated for the sake of halting a potential plot to bomb the subway system there. Spying, then, can be a much more short-lived activity in today's world. But what I was fascinated to learn was, and that's confounding some of the pessimism, was that none of this has killed human intelligence. It's transformed it. And broadly speaking, the game is much less solitary, less paranoid, faster. But at the same time, it's also become more dangerous and more short-lived, even more successful. That's why I compare the modern human agent to a butterfly, the short but beautiful butterfly. So the business has become less solitary. GCHQ were the country boys out in Cheltenham. MI5 or Box were a bunch of file collators who were scorned for their ability to run agents. And behind the jokes, there was a reason for putting up walls. As the CIA traitor Aldrich Ames showed with all the agents he got killed, need to know was a life or death matter. But that has changed. The solitary, paranoid world has to a large extent been replaced by teamwork. The big danger is less from an insider, but from missing the lead, failing to connect the dots. And that was the standout failure that let 9/11 happen. The game is also faster. Cold War spying could be incredibly tedious, shadowing some Soviet diplomat for months or years to work out if he had a weak spot. It was also hopelessly inefficient. The pitches rarely worked. But now, according to people involved, it can be like a chess game on steroids. There isn't time to spare. A potential source with doubts or weaknesses might, for example, be identified by a surveillance of a terror group, monitored, and then within days stopped as he passes through an airport and be pitched to become a secret agent. And then it can all end so quickly too. That happened with the carefully conceived operation when Britain sent an agent of Saudi origin to spy in the Yemen in 2012. It was halted when he got so close they handed him a bomb to smuggle on a transatlantic airline. The plot was stopped, and with the help of a few leaks in Washington, the agent was blown. Another point there in the Yemen case, and more widely, was the sheer danger for the agent. We're sending people into real, dangerous, denied spaces at the moment, like Syria, like Waziristan, where rescue is nearly impossible. Some agents are being killed, and that's proved tough psychologically for some of the case officers. So in summary, here's the difference. Oleg Gordievsky was a mole inside the KGB for 11 years. Today's star agent may be recruited in a snapshot arrest at an airport, carry a tracking device, betray a bomb plot, and then retire with £1 million, or end up being killed, all within the space of a few months or even weeks. The other big shift is technology. There's a real problem with technical obsession, with people who only really trust something that comes out of a computer, who adore its false certainty. And I've seen, describe in the book some, I think, quite shocking examples where the wrong people have been killed because conflicts have been exacerbated because of the failure to go beyond technical means and because of this false certainty in technology. But equally, the flip side is that human is of itself becoming more and more integrated with technology. This is an age of self-espionage where many of us devote huge amounts of energy, particularly young people, and diligence to effectively tracking down our own movements, describing our own network, and recording our every thought and action digitally. This isn't just material to hack and intercept, but with intrusive surveillance, it provides a way of reaching into people's thoughts, spotting aberrant behaviour, mapping out a network, and altogether providing many tools that help to identify a potential agent. All of which can, when it works well, transform the task of spotting a potential traitor within a terror group, for example, from months or years to weeks, even days. And technology has another key role that remedies one of the weaknesses of human. With the help of digital techniques, human stories can be verified. When someone says they were in Vienna last week in a coffee shop, you can see from the records that they were there. In short, human and technical methods of espionage are becoming inseparable. So that's how things have changed. By way of conclusion, I should just add a couple of things that I think haven't changed. First of all, there are old enemies too. I've talked about new spying and the new types of threats, the new types of secrets, but getting strategic information from major world powers that may use their strength to threaten us remains a priority. And you can't disinvent spycraft when we have 1,800 nuclear warheads that remain on high alert in Russia and when nuclear weapons technology continues to spread. And secondly and lastly, there's the need for patience. Good things come around. As I learned, to my surprise, almost all key American agents in the Soviet Union were pure volunteers, not recruits at all. And equally now, there are times when we'll have absolutely no sources, but not for long. In time, people get tired of conflict. They start to fall out. Some of the best recent sources for our agents in Britain have been young radical Muslims embroiled in jihadism, even reaching their camps, but recoiling at the extremes and depravity of what was on offer. People start to realise they're working for losers, and all of a sudden they're ready to shot their comrades. And you need people prepared to shot their husband and brother. But it does take time. And that's one reason I questioned the US policy I witnessed in Iraq and Afghanistan of assassination and of killing the leadership of all these terror groups, because it makes for constant rejuvenation. Human intelligence has its limits. There is a limit on how fast we can get it, and to a limit to what it achieves and how often it's right. But we'd be in peril without it. Thank you.